Several more Palestinians have been killed as Israel keeps pounding the besieged Gaza Strip using warplanes and artillery units. Palestinian Prime Minister is calling for concrete action by the international community to stop Israeli killings in the Gaza Strip. Iran says there will be no agreement in the Vienna talks to revive the nuclear deal unless there is consensus on all the issues. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Zanjafik. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with developments on the Palestinian occupied territory, several more Palestinians have been killed as Israel keeps pounding the besieged Gaza Strip using warplanes and artillery units. The latest fatalities include three in western Gaza, where a car was hit by a tank shell. One person was also killed in the city of Jabalia. Israeli forces have targeted a Palestinian government building and a factory. Warplanes fired dozens of missiles overnight into different parts of the densely populated Palestinian territory, causing deaths and devastation. More than 200 people in Gaza have been killed, over 1,200 injured, since Israel began pounding Gaza last Monday. Amnesty International has urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the attacks on a media and residential towers, as well as a refugee camp, as war crimes. In the meantime, Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh rocket attacks on Israel, and that in retaliation for the regime's relentless onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The military wing of Hamas resistance movement says its rockets hit an Israeli battleship off the shore of the Gaza Strip. Ezzedin al-Qassam brigades also hit the Israeli airbase of Fahad Zarin with rockets. The group had earlier targeted Ashkelon and Kisufim with a barrage of projectiles. Meanwhile, the Islamic Jihad movement says that the military wing al-Quds brigades fired volleys of rockets at the cities of Sderot and Netivot. The group described the attack as a response to Israel's massive bombardment of Gaza on Sunday. 10 Israelis have been killed and hundreds more injured by Palestinian rocket fire. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya has called for more concrete actions by the international community against Israel. Speaking in the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, he said that mere condemnations aren't enough anymore. He urged the UN to issue a resolution that would describe Israeli actions against the Palestinians as illegal and illegitimate. Shataya said that the crimes that Tel Aviv has committed against the Palestinians have to be punished by international law. He called for an immediate end to the onslaught, saying that any delay means the renewal of Israel's killing license against the Palestinians. The Palestinian Prime Minister also called upon allies to summon Israeli ambassadors and to stop trade relations with the regime. Now, that's while the UN Security Council's first open debate on the tensions between Israel and Palestine has failed to provide any solution to the crisis. The 50-member council held a virtual meeting on the situation in Palestine. That was on the request of China, Norway, and Tunisia. The council met privately twice last week over the worsening violence in the occupied territories. Of course, it failed to agree on a joint statement due to the U.S. obstruction. The third session was chaired by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, strongly criticized Washington for obstructing a unanimous voice over the issue.
Regrettably, simply because of the obstruction of one country, the Security Council hasn't been able to speak with one voice. We call upon the U.S. to shoulder its due responsibilities, take a just position, and together with most of the international community, support the Security Council in easing the situation.
He also called for a ceasefire as a priority, demanding an immediate action by the international community. Meantime, Iran has slammed the council for what it calls unjustified inaction and deadly silence on the Israeli massacre of Palestinians. Iran's primary representative to the UN, Majid Akhlavanchi, says that the Security Council's inaction has emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with more savagery, which is unfortunately supported by the U.S. Now, dock workers in central North Italy have planned to withhold their cooperation with a weapon shipment process after finding that it was aimed at further armament of Israel amid the bloodlet in the Gaza Strip. Max Civoli has the story from Rome.
Dock workers from the Italian-based union USB operating at the port of Livorno in northern Tuscany had planned to refuse to load a shipment of arms after discovering the load was headed to Israel. The shipment included explosives and precision-guided munitions destined for the port city of Ashdod in southern Israel. In a note, the USB union has explained that dock workers took the decision to stop loading the shipment, fearing the weapons would end up killing the innocent Palestinians already hit by deadly attacks over the past days, which caused hundreds of civilian victims, including women and children.
It's not right that our work is instrumental to the death of Palestinians. That's why we refuse to load the ship. We don't want to be part of this injustice. We don't want to be accomplices to the massacre of Palestinian civilians. Furthermore, we have noticed that an increasing number of shipments transiting through our ports are loaded with weapons, and this is very dangerous for us workers and for the people residing around the ports.
Dock workers had been tipped off by an NGO named the Weapon Watch over the weapons they were supposed to load onto the Asiatic Island, a vessel flying Singaporean flag docked at the port of Livorno.
The Weapon Watch is an independent observatory on arms transfers through Italian ports. According to a representative of the observatory, the legal part of the arms business transiting through Italy is mirrored by a vast illegal trade in arms that fuels violence, atrocities, and civil wars across the globe.
The truth is that these arms transfers are routine. Dock workers and the general population are now more aware of the direct consequences of these deadly loads since the media are reporting on the bombardments over the Gaza Strip.
The NGO, the Weapon Watch, has urged the Italian government to consider suspending some or all Italian military exports to Israel. Rome has recently halted the sale of thousands of missiles to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates due to their involvement in the Yemen conflict. Max Civili, Rome.
In other news, the Yemeni people have turned out in their thousands in solidarity with Palestinians in the face of the Israeli onslaught. Demonstrators in the northwestern city of Sada chanted slogans condemning the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. They expressed unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. Protesters urged the people in Gaza to go on resisting the Israeli aggression. A similar event is set to be staged in the capital, Sana'a, later today. Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that a response by the Palestinian fighters revealed Israel's fragility and weakness. Well, those demonstrations aren't happening in Islamic countries, only in Austria. Protesters have staged a gathering outside the office of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, and that after expressed solidarity with Tel Aviv and raised the Israeli flag on the state building. Activists say they are outraged that the government has officially taken the side of the aggressor. They want that flag down. Omar Leski has a report.
Hundreds of Austrian protesters gather outside the office of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, expressing their anger at the government's decision to take Israel's side as it continues its deadly bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip.
Protesters were not given legal permission for a large demonstration, but they did gather outside the Chancellery, expressing outrage at the fact that the Israeli flag has been hoisted on top of this building.
Organizers said that by raising its flag and expressing solidarity with Israel, the government has violated Austria's constitution.
Our main protest is we want this flag to be down because this flag is against our constitution. Our constitution stipulates neutrality, and our government takes side with a war party, with a party which violates systematically the rights of other people, of the Palestinians. They evict them, they ethnically cleanse them, they take their land.
Political commentators say Austria's one-sided political position runs contrary to the country's traditional policies founded on democracy.
This is unbelievable, and I'm sure that many of the Austrian people, because nobody was asked about this, this was a coup d'etat, this with the flag. And I'm sure that many of the Austrian people don't accept this. I'm here because we are siding the Palestinians, we are fighting their rights, but we are also protecting our rights as Austrian, as European Democrats.
We want the Palestinian people to know, and we want the Israeli government and the Austrian government to know that we will not be quiet, that we cannot be quiet down, and that the Palestinian people have a right on their land, and they have to stop this colonial expansion now.
Activists say they will continue their attempts to pile public pressure on the government and are calling on authorities to give them back their right to demonstrate. Homolezki, Vienna.
Now, in other news, Iran saying there will be no agreement in the Vienna talks to revive the nuclear deal unless there is consensus on all the issues. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says Iran and the remaining parties to the deal are going on with their technical negotiations. The Islamic Republic is not seeking an agreement that's not according to its policies and executive instructions. Khatibzadeh stressed that Iran will give no access beyond the safeguards agreement to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tehran has time and again said Washington has to take the first step toward reviving the nuclear deal by unconditional removing all the sanctions in a verifiable way. The U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, reinstating sanctions on the country. India has reported more than 281,000 new confirmed COVID cases in one day. The country lost more than 4,100 people to the coronavirus in the same period. Health Ministry is saying the number of fatalities in the country has surpassed 274,000. Total caseload is nearing the grim milestone of 25 million. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has sounded the alarm over the rapid spread of the virus across the nation. The World Health Organization has classified the Indian variant of the COVID-19 as a global concern. WHO warning that the second year of the pandemic could be worse than the first. The grim situation has caused severe shortages of hospital beds and medical and oxygen supplies in the South Asian country. Okay, now let's see what election news we have for you. The Constitutional Council has held its first meeting to vet presidential hopefuls for the next month election. The council's spokesman says they examined the credentials and other documents submitted by the potential candidates. Abbas Ali Khatrai says that the next meeting of the Constitutional Council will be held on Wednesday. The vetting body will release the final list of approved presidential candidates on May 26th and 27th. Some 600 people have registered to run for president. The hopefuls include Judiciary Chief Ibrahim Raisi, First Vice President Asaf Jahangiri, former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, and former Defense Minister Hossein Dehghan. Iran's 13th presidential election will be held on the 18th of June. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote. Well, like I said, Iran's first vice president, Asaf Jahangiri, has registered for the June 18th presidential election, and this is the second time that he's running for the executive post. The following report takes a closer look at his profile.
Asaf Jahangiri was born in 1958 in Kerman. He holds a PhD in industrial management. Jahangiri began his political career following the 1979 revolution. He became the deputy head of the agriculture department in Kerman in 1980 and was appointed as its head 2 years later. Jahangiri has also served as a member of parliament for 8 years. He was appointed as the governor of Isfahan in September 1992 by then-President Akbar Hoshemi Rafsanjani and held the position until 1997 when he was nominated by then-President Mohammad Khatami as the Minister of Mines and Metals and was confirmed by the Parliament. His portfolio was later changed to the Minister of Industries and Mines. Jahangiri is the co-founder of Executive Construction Party and served as its Secretary General from 2006 to 2010. In 2013, after Hassan Rouhani won the presidential election, Jahangiri was appointed as the first vice president. He was nominated for the 2017 presidential election, but withdrew in the final days of campaigning and endorsed Rouhani. Later, after Rouhani won the election, Jahangiri was reappointed as first vice president. On May 15, Jahangiri registered to run for president. He called for a huge turnout in the vote to overcome the problems the country is facing. The first vice president described his ideal government as an entity at the service of the people. He said a practical government should respond to people's demands and act transparently. As a president, Jahangiri said he would pick honest people for his cabinet and resolutely fight any forms of corruption inside his administration.
Now let's see who the next person is. Judiciary Chief Ibrahim Raisi. He's also officially declared his bid for presidency and more than a year before the elections are being held in Iran. Now this next report takes a look at his profile and the posts that he has held over the past years.
Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric who was born in 1960. He has held several key posts in the judiciary branch since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, serving as the prosecutor of the cities of Karaj and Hamadan, as well as the capital Tehran. In 1994, Raisi was appointed as the head of General Inspection Office. He also served as first Deputy Chief of Justice of Iran and the Attorney General of the country. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astan Quds Razavi. That's an umbrella administrative organization managing the holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam in Mashhad and several other institutions. In March 2019, Raisi was appointed as the Judiciary Chief, a post he currently serves. Raisi is also an incumbent member of the Assembly of Experts. He has now announced that he will join the race for the June presidential election in Iran. Raisi registered for the election on May 15th and said he's running as an independent under the slogan of fighting corruption. Raisi says he wants to participate in the presidential poll because of public demand and has pledged change in managing the country's affairs. Raisi ran for president in the previous election in 2017 when he gained 38% of the vote. He ranked second behind incumbent president Hassan Rouhani.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don and I welcome you back to another episode of the subcontinent. Since now I'll be taking a long leave, I would like you to meet our new host, Mr. Mehdi Gulzadeh.
Thank you, John.
Well, as he said,
Mehdi Golzadeh. From now on, I'll be doing the rest of the episodes. Our episodes aim at to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Please stay with us.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the deadly surge of the second wave of the COVID pandemic in India. Then we will explore how the Indian government has managed the catastrophe so far and its plans to stop the spread across the subcontinent.
Before we delve into our main story on the coronavirus pandemic in India, let's talk about another tragedy that has been plaguing the globe, Takfiri terrorism.
A car bomb was detonated across a school in the neighborhood of Adashtel Barchi, and when students rushed out in panic, two more bombs exploded. The neighborhood is home to a large community of Shias from the Hazara ethnic minority, which has been often targeted by the extremists. More than 80 people were killed and about 150 more injured in the Saturday attack.
Teenage girls in Afghanistan are torn between fears and ambitions. Fear from the rising Takfiri presence in their country and ambitions of education and freedom. Being a schoolgirl in Afghanistan was already difficult, as they had to study in tattered tents or the open air, and the schools were desperately overcrowded without essential facilities such as toilets. But the hardships and threats they face outside school may change or even end their lives forever.
Indians are suffering from a devastating wave of pandemic like no country has ever experienced. Yes, it is true that the size of the population of the country makes it an arduous task to contain an epidemic of this magnitude. But the government's negligence about this second wave is taking a heavy toll on the people. My co-host Mehdi will walk you through some of the frightening figures.
The recent rise in the number of COVID cases has registered a peak in almost all the charts by the relevant authorities. India has recorded over 23 million cases of COVID, while the death toll is about 250,000. The weekly number of infections has averaged a record of over 390,000, while the country's daily coronavirus cases rose by 330,000, accounting for one in every three deaths reported worldwide each day.
The deadly surge in India's COVID cases has overwhelmed the subcontinent, and it may even grow to a global disaster. This second wave of the pandemic is larger and spreading more rapidly than the last one, and is also affecting more people across age groups, including children and infants. Since the start of April, daily infections have been soaring. People are gasping to stay alive as they wait for critical care beds and treatment. In addition to families, the increasing rise in infections has placed an enormous strain on health and critical care facilities. Hospitals cannot handle the load, and families are scrambled for scarce medicines and oxygen cylinders or a doctor's appointment. In many cities, mass funeral pyres and cremations never stop in the parking lots that have been turned into crematoriums to accommodate the rising number of the dead. Dozens of bodies wash up on the banks of rivers every day, while the locals complain about the authorities' inaction to control the unbearable smell.
It is not hidden the fact that it's pretty out of control, especially last week. Now it looks a little bit under control this week and past 2 days. So if I analyze why it went out, probably there are multiple factors. One factor is related with the people, means people were little bit complacent. They got vaccination, including healthcare worker. We thought that, okay, everybody was tired of masks. Everybody is tired of, not having, you can say, to get together with each other. So human is a social person, isn't it? They try to find out the way to meet each other. So they started meeting. They thought that pandemic and now this virus is not going to come again. And even if it's come and we are vaccinated, especially high-risk population got vaccinated. So one is that complacency from the people side. Second, there were election rallies. There were farmer rallies. So probably people also thought, got a message that even at the highest level, probably this is not going to come. Thirdly, of course, it looks like some complacency from other like government agencies, and so nobody expected.
The World Health Organization has said that the variant of the COVID-19 behind the acceleration of India's explosive outbreak has been found in dozens of countries, not only in the subcontinent, but all over the world. According to the UN Health Agency, the B.1.617 variant had been detected in more than 4,500 samples uploaded to an open access database from 44 countries in all six regions of WHO. Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal are India's neighbors worst hit by the double mutant, while the UK had reported the largest number of COVID cases caused by the variant.
Lancet Medical Journal has said Modi's government should be held responsible for presiding over a self-inflicted national catastrophe. According to an estimate by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, that is an independent global health research center of the University of Washington, the deaths could potentially reach a staggering 1 million by August this year.
In the early days of 2021, India seemed to be on the path to normalcy when the daily positive cases were reported less than 10,000, the lowest in about 8 to 10 months. Vaccinations had started and hospitalization had decreased. India then started to open up and ease restrictions while the virus was evolving and mutating. Many research centers and organizations had predicted the second wave, but they did not know about the severity and when it would hit the country. But the government decided to ignore that. The Indian government's handling of the pandemic has created public uproar, while many in the world have pinned the blame on Prime Minister Modi for the new wave because he had ignored many warnings about the looming catastrophe. In early March, a forum of scientific advisers set up by the Modi administration had issued stern warnings of a new and more contagious variant taking hold in the country. This was after a parliamentary committee had warned of a shortage of oxygen in the coming months. Despite the warnings, the federal government did not seek to impose major restrictions to contain the spread of the virus. Some critics say arrogance, hyper-nationalism and bureaucratic incompetence have combined to create a crisis of epic proportions as the government allowed religious gatherings and political rallies regardless of the facts. Millions of people, largely unmasked, attended election rallies for the 2021 assembly election that were held by Modi, leaders of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party and opposition politicians. The other super spreader event was Kumbh Mela, a major pilgrimage and festival in Hinduism. Millions of devotees took part in the gathering without any form of social distancing. The pilgrims then went back to their home states and catapulted the contagion.
This wave is different from the previous wave, and it is not only infectiousness, but the severity of infection is very high. So we are able to grasp the use of steroid in particular window that has helped us in decreasing the oxygen requirement in the patients. So everybody has learned over past 2 weeks. including government, including public, and including physicians and clinicians. And also people have started vaccinating themselves, and probably it may not help in this way, but of course we may be able to revert the third wave, which somebody projected that it may come.
India is the world's biggest producer of COVID vaccines, but shortages of the shots in some states have hindered the opening of inoculations for all adults. Some people say the shortage is because India exported about 60 million doses to 70 countries, but some experts believe the problem goes deeper. India produces over 2.5 million doses of vaccines every day. Even if it manages to vaccinate more than 2 million people per day, the nationwide vaccination will take over 2 years. Moreover, dozens of countries are sending large shipments of oxygen products to India, but the virus-hit country lacks the necessary means to distribute them to the people in need. Adding to the misery, there are also reports of deaths in people who had received both doses of their vaccines. The Indian double mutant may need new or moderated vaccine formulas.
If we look at the real-time experience of past 1 month, what I can say with some surety that those people who were vaccinated by Covishield actually didn't land up in major severe pneumonia. Now, when we talk about this is a very generalized statement. It has to have a lot of exceptions. Now, look at the Moderna, look at the other vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna. They also had 5,800 infections though there were not many much mutations, but without mutation, there were so many breakthrough infections. So it's very hard to say that those vaccines can prevent mutation more effectively than Covishield. One, it's a time will tell. Second, at times the studies which are done in, you know, at a vitro level, at a vivo level, in a very small group of people, the studies being done, they were done when we didn't had so much mutation. So if you look at the efficacy of Moderna and Pfizer as compared to newer vaccine like Novavax and Johnson & Johnson, Nuvaxovid, Covishield, these efficiencies of 90-95% were there when we had original Wuhan strain. Now, they have not been time-tested with these type of triple mutation, double mutation, and which evades immunity. One. So one is not very sure, but since we haven't seen them, actually they haven't tested, so we feel that, okay, they may work, because we are humans, we always feel that there is some hope. So I think we need more studies, and if this type of infection unfortunately strikes the places where people have been fully vaccinated by Pfizer and Moderna, then we'll come to know actual ground situation.
India spends only about 3% of its GDP on healthcare. The country is in serious need of infrastructure. The third wave of the pandemic is coming while the Indian variants have been spreading to the neighboring countries. If not contained, the Indian pandemic may be able to further deepen the global plague.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Tina Thacker, Assistant Editor of The Economic Times. Now, Tina, why did the pandemic get out of hand in India?
So right now we are seeing a massive lethal wave of COVID virus in the country. We have variants which are circulating in India. But the variants are alone could not be blamed for the dramatic surge in cases and deaths seen in India. The country appeared to have let its guard down with huge social mixing and large gatherings. India felt that the crisis was over, dropping mask wearing and other protection measures, but the virus was quietly spreading. So here we are, we have seen big election rallies happening, and we have also seen religious, this festival where we saw huge gatherings, and this has all led to this situation, I would say.
How is the government handling the situation, and what grade do you give the Modi government?
That's a really sad part that we are not just seeing COVID cases, but people have been dying due to inadequate supplies of oxygen, medicines, something which is as basic as a hospital bed. People are not getting hospital beds. So the health infrastructure is actually crumbling, which is a really sad part and shows the sad state of affairs. Instead of government, Twitter has become the new helpline where strangers are helping each other, getting medicines, getting beds. I think government is doing its bit, but probably that's not enough, and the situation has got out of hand.
What can it do to reduce the severity of the disaster? Basically, what can we hope for?
So we have inoculated just about like less than 2% of the population right now. And given the size of the country, it's a Herculean task. Then there's a shortage of vaccines. We don't have enough supplies. We have only two companies which are supplying vaccines to the country. Though we expect more companies to get approval in days to come, we can hope for maybe, importing vaccines from other countries, like, for instance, U.S., which is not using the AstraZeneca vaccine, the supplies can be diverted to India. Then we have J&J, where people are hesitant to, take J&J, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So that's the only silver lining that we see right now to get enough people getting vaccinated.
Who are the most hit in India, and what can be done for them?
We have to keep keep updating with the testing. We are not testing enough. We don't know if the testing has reached to the rural areas. So, and this time around, what we've seen is that the virus has impacted more young people, which is also in the productive age group, getting impacted because of the virus. So we have to at least ensure that the basic medical care is provided to them, at least to the people.
Tina, we'll give you a break so we can see media and cyberspace.
Viruses mutate all the time, producing different versions or variants of themselves. Most of these mutations are significant, and some may even make the virus less dangerous. But others can make it more contagious and harder to vaccinate against. This variant, officially known as B.1.617, was first detected in India in October. Researchers in India are now trying to pinpoint what is behind the unprecedented surge, which could be due to an unfortunate confluence of factors, including the emergence of particularly infectious variants, a rise in unrestricted social interactions, and low vaccine coverage. Untangling the causes could be helpful to governments trying to suppress or prevent similar surges around the world. India's laboratories are struggling to keep up with the punishing COVID-19 surge as its scientists try to track and understand new coronavirus mutations. The World Health Organization has classified a variant first identified in India, known as B.1.617, as a variant of concern, saying preliminary studies suggested it may be more contagious than other variants. The WHO scientists didn't report any evidence that vaccines aren't effective against the new variant. India is in the process of ramping up its capacity to do genomic sequencing to track changes in the virus's genetic makeup by examining positive test samples. While experts suggest that the mortality rate in the second wave is similar to last year's wave, data shared by the Indian government clearly shows that the ratio of young adults in the 30 to 40 age group dying of the disease is higher than the first wave. This means there are more young children losing their parents, and some have been left totally alone as their entire immediate family has succumbed to the virus.
Tina, thank you for the wait. And now India's neighbors are already reporting cases of the Indian version. How long does it take for the wave to spread throughout the globe, and what happens then?
You know, so the variants have arisen in various parts of the world, including the British variant, which is the UK variant, which first entered in India, and we still have it. Now we have variants traveling abroad from India. We have South African variant, which has traveled to some places. So everybody has to keep a watch out for them. The main protection against them is only two things: prevent spreading by masking and by avoiding super spreading events. And second is to just, you know, ramp up vaccinations so that people don't get seriously ill. That's what we can do right now.
Now, Tina, considering the large size and population of the country, is nationwide vaccination even possible? What is a feasible scenario? How long does it take, and how much vaccines are needed?
Yeah. So, you know, India is a vast country, but definitely it is possible. It will take a long time because, you know, we have shortage of vaccines. So ideally, if you have plenty of vaccines available, you could go down to people as young as 18 years. But now that India has announced that they're going to vaccinate people who are above 18 plus, it's going to take some time because, you know, there are not enough vaccine supplies. So we have to just make sure that we have to protect our 45 plus population, because they are the ones who are most vulnerable. And, you know, maybe look at younger people with comorbidities. But we have to just use that rationing and triaging as long as we have got limited supplies of vaccines.
And one last question, how can the international community help the situation?
You know, as of now, we are getting a lot of foreign aid. A lot of countries have helped India in getting oxygen concentrators, medicines. So we have a lot of foreign aid coming in to India, which has really helped. India has been leading a push from lower and middle income countries at the World Trade Organization to do away patents on vaccines. So we'll have to see how other countries react to the same, you know, faced with this possibility of losing out on their profit margins and monopoly. We are hopeful now that the US has supported it. So we may see this coming, which would mean not immediately, but maybe in the long run, we'll see more vaccines coming in, and you know, it will be cheaper as well. So that's the silver lining that I see now.
Tina, thank you for your precious time, and we'd love to have you back on the program again. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and the cyberspace.
This account, named When the Flame Turns Blue, believes the Indian pandemic is now a global concern. Rujana Punjab has appreciated the Indian Navy's efforts to bring the much-needed oxygen tanks from abroad. Akanksha Sharma has reflected concerns by an Indian blogger about the country's mismanagement of the pandemic before he succumbed to the disease. Niyati Bava has tweeted about an indigenous drug that may help in oxygen regulation in COVID patients.
All right, so that was our episode covering the second wave of the COVID pandemic in India. This was also my last episode as the host of this show, and I must say it has been an honor serving you for all this time. My colleague Mehdi now will carry the torch in our upcoming programs. On to Mehdi.
Thank you, John. We will meet again next week.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Today we want to talk about one of the contemporary issues that we seeing in the news and the media, the problem of refugees. We have currently about, according to United Nations Refugee Agency, they say there are at least 79.5 million people around the world have been forced to flee their homes. So that's a huge number, because sometimes you have countries, the population is way less than that. There are countries who have, from 5 million, their population, to 20, 30. Now, this is 79.5. That's equal to sometimes to two, three countries put together are forced to flee their homes, either due to war, either due to famine, either due to natural disasters, but mainly due to wars and oppression in their own countries. Among those 79.5 million, there are 26 million refugees, which are being not only forcefully, they have fled their homes, but they had to seek refuge somewhere else. And amongst those, about millions of them are under the age, or according to the statistics, 26 million of them are under the age of 18, which is also a scary, staggering number if you think about it. So you have a majority of those who flee their homes are either women and children who are under the age of 18. So this is a crisis that is facing humanity. Now, the statistics of refugees, it's very upsetting to see that we have countries who, you know, to a certain extent, they're modernized, or they have facilities, or they have the means and tools for people to live a happy life, yet they are fleeing their countries. For example, in Syria, you have 6.6 million people, refugees. In Afghanistan, for example, you have 2.7 refugees. In Myanmar, you have 1 million people, refugees. In Turkey, you have 3.6 million. In Pakistan, you have 1.4 million. And each country would have millions of people fleeing their countries, either out of fear for their lives, or either because they are subjected to oppression. So some countries don't have wars, but the oppression that the governments impose on them, it makes them flee their countries. And among these numbers, so you have 34 million are children, according to the statistics that I'm reading from the UN Refugee Agency. And if you look at these numbers, they're just shocking. It's just absolutely shocking to see you have millions and millions of people don't have homes, who live in tents, who live in conditions which are inhumane, unbearable condition, either in deserts or either in cold places where it's not just cold, it's below zero in many degrees. And I've seen pictures of you know, ice cold, freezing, snowing campsites. And you have women and children living in these tents without power, without gas, without water, and without, you know, clothes to keep them warm during these winter nights and winter days. And which is very sad to see that we still are experiencing such a thing in the 20th or 21st century. Now, let's take a break, and inshallah, we will continue this topic.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. So just before the break, we said we have millions upon millions of people who are forced out of their homes, and they had to flee forcefully because either war or oppression that's been done to them in their countries. What is ironic is that those people in these countries, be it, for example, in the Middle Eastern countries or Asian countries, they flee to the West, to the Western countries. And this Western countries, they open their doors to refugees. Well, they used to, not anymore, or some at least, just to be fair. They open the doors to the refugees and, you know, trying to be humanitarian as possible. But if you open your eyes and look at the bigger picture, you will see that most of these countries who are oppressive, who have oppressive regimes and who are in war, these wars are caused by the same countries, the same Western countries who are taking these refugees and claiming that they are being humanitarian. For example, when you have millions of people fleeing from Syria and Yemen, millions of people are refugees. Who was the cause of the war in their countries? Isn't it in America? Isn't it in the West? Isn't the West and their allies? Or just the Yemenis decided to kill each other? Obviously they're not, because the West, they are the cause of everything. When you have millions of people, for example, fleeing Iraq or fleeing from Saudi Arabia, only because America is giving protection to the Saudis, for example. They give them protection, they oppress their people, and then people have no choice but to flee. Where you have people, for example, in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other countries, where they are also subjected to the sanctions and to the oppression of the West itself, it forces people to leave. So either the West provides cover for these oppressive regimes to continue, or either they directly get involved in these wars, which forces people to flee, for example, in Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Afghanistan. The West, they had a hand in it, like a first hand in destroying these countries that makes people flee and become refugees in other countries. So when you have millions of people who are fleeing to Turkey, for example, from Syria, Turkey itself, they are involved in many acts where they provide weapons and they provide ISIS fighters. The ISIS fighters, they go through Turkey and Turkey gives them the green light. And then yet, you see Turkey saying, well, we are humanitarian. We are doing this and that for them. Well, how about you prevent it from happening in the first place? How about the West and Europe, in the first place, they stop their involvement in the Middle East or in poor countries so this would not happen? Why didn't the West get involved in Myanmar, for example, when millions of Muslims were fleeing their countries and they were prosecuted and being killed, and the West does not care, turning a blind eye to it? So where's the humanitarian, or where's the human rights in this regard? So those who defend human rights and those who think they are being humanitarian, they are usually the cause of those people fleeing their homes and being prosecuted by their own regimes to begin with. So let us not fool ourselves and put dust in our eyes and just blame ourselves or our countries and forget who has caused the problem to begin with. Now, we'll leave it up to here, and inshallah we continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.